Division 6. We have two cases on our docket this morning. The first is People v. Jorgensen, and the second is Pierce v. Parrish. And are the attorneys ready in People v. Jorgensen?
The appellant is ready, Your Honor.
All right. And have the attorneys received handouts on how we do procedures here in oral argument?
I understand there's 15 minutes allowed. We'll break it down.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. And we also have a lighting system on the clock. So when the light turns to yellow, it means you have 5 minutes left. So the appellant may, if you wish, reserve time for rebuttal. When the light turns red, that means your time is up. So if the parties are ready, we're ready to proceed.
May it please the court. A brief outline or background of this case, Your Honor, is that Mr. Jorgensen was stopped, a traffic stop, on June 29th.
Would you state your name and the name of the party you're representing, just for the record?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Recording this.
My name is Neil McFarland, and I represent Gerald Jorgensen. Should I proceed? Mr. Jorgensen was stopped on June 29th, 2003. And the date is important because the trial didn't occur for some 2.5 years after that. The officer found illegal drugs and a handgun in the car. There was also a passenger, Bill Hillhakey. That's important. He was in the passenger seat. He's the government's primary witness. Jorgensen was charged with two counts relating to illegal drugs, one count of forgery for a false driver's license, possession of a firearm, and five counts of habitual criminal. He was convicted, sentenced to 36 years, 28 years, and 8 years concurrent. And that's the background. The first point involves really three claims. And it has to do with a new counsel appearing at trial. As I stated, the arrest was back in June of 2003. The trial started February 27th, 2006. 3 days before the trial started, a new attorney filed a motion entering his appearance, and the trial court denied to allow that counsel enter, and that is why the basis of the first claim. In that two-year, eight-month period, six different attorneys had represented Mr. Jorgensen, and that's one of the big reasons the court talks about. The last three were alternative defense counsel, the one before that a public defender, first two were private attorneys, and there were six different trial settings basically going along with change of counsel, plus at one point Mr. Jorgensen, who was incarcerated, had been very severely beaten. He'd beaten in the head with a pipe by another inmate and couldn't appear medically. At any rate, 3 days before the trial was to start, a man named Thomas Henry, an attorney licensed and registered in Colorado and in good standing, filed a motion entering his appearance and asking for a new trial setting. Mr. Henry lives in Omaha, Nebraska, even though he does a lot of practice in Colorado. He had a conflict in Omaha the morning of the 27th, did not appear. The alternative defense counsel did appear and filed a motion himself to withdraw. On the ground, two grounds really. One was that Mr. Jorgensen was dissatisfied with his representation, and two, that he didn't feel he had authority or jurisdiction because Mr. Jorgensen had a new attorney. Authority as an alternative defense counsel. The court heard from Mr. Braddock, who's the ADC counsel. He heard from Mr. Jorgensen, and he accepted a call from Mr. Henry from Omaha, Nebraska, late that morning. That was all before the jury was sworn. And Mr. Henry then filed a motion, apparently faxed in a written motion, asking that he be allowed to enter and represent Mr. Jorgensen at trial. And I think that also occurred before the jury was sworn.
Mr. McFarland, may I ask you, on the motion to discharge Mr. Braddock, in your brief you were indicating that the court did not hold a hearing to inquire what were the reasons to have Mr. Braddock discharged. And I would just like to ask you, what was the court supposed to do in that instance that it did not do?
Your Honor, under the statute or under the law, it seems clear that when a defendant wants to discharge his counsel or when an attorney moves to withdraw, the court must conduct a hearing and find out the specific reasons for those motions, primarily whether or not there's a lack of communication between the attorney and the client, whether the attorney, if there's any reason the attorney can be, or reasons he cannot be effective, any other reasons that might show that he cannot render effective assistance. And the court did not do that in this case. Some of those reasons did come out.
Excuse me, didn't the court ask the defendant to explain his reasons?
The court did ask him, and he stated, first of all, he stated, I'm...
Why was that inquiry not sufficient?
Well, it was not sufficient. It did not go to... It went to some trial strategy problems between he and Mr. Braddock, but it did not go to a lack of communication. It did not go to whether Mr. Braddock would explain things to him, whether he disclosed things to him, other things. It went to certain trial strategy. The reasons Mr. Jorgensen stated, one was a medical reason that he was blurred vision and dizzy because of medical problems, but also went into that he didn't feel that Mr. Braddock had provided, at least in a timely manner, discovery to him. He had just learned of some telephone calls that apparently Mr. Braddock had known for some time. And the second reason was that he had listed 18 witnesses he wanted called, and Mr. Braddock had told him he was not going to call any of those witnesses. One of those witnesses, incidentally, was Bobby Stevens, who could explain where Lacey McGrath, another witness, had obtained the handgun involved and placed in the car, and surprisingly ironically one of the ADC attorneys who was representing Mr. Jorgensen withdrew because he had previously represented Ms. Stevens. But the court did not, they did have a hearing or a sort of a hearing where the court allowed the parties to make their statements, and by parties I'm saying Mr. Jorgensen and his attorney. But he did not ask any questions of Mr. Jorgensen as to whether or not he could communicate with counsel or any details of why counsel is not being effective in his representation. He simply asked him some questions about what medication are you on, how long have you been on that medication. I think those are the only two questions. And it's very clear from the cases I've cited, the Gonzalez v. Lopez, the Mestis case, that the court has a duty to inquire, hold a hearing, and inquire into the reasons supporting a request for discharge of counsel or counsel's motion to withdraw from further representation. I don't know if you have any further questions.
Well, I have a question as to the one of the other issues that was brought up was Mr. Jorgensen indigent at the time? And what was the court's duty at that point as far as any duty to inquire or hold a hearing?
Well, the court made the ruling that he was denying Mr. Henry's entry of appearance, or not accepting his entry of appearance because of there was no proof that Mr. Jorgensen was not indigent at that point. And I don't think that reason really matters because the Sixth Amendment protects the right to choice of counsel when a person can retain his attorney or even if an attorney will represent him free of charge. So I don't think the indigency matter is an important factor because in very express language it sets the case is set out that if the defendant can obtain services of an attorney, whether he retains him or not, as long as he has counsel, then he has a choice of that counsel.
All right, well, let me follow up with another question. I think that Mr. Braddock was indicating that he could not proceed if Mr. Jorgensen were not indigent.
Right.
Okay, and was that an act, can you talk about that a little bit?
That is because he was appointed to represent Mr. Jorgensen as an alternative defense counsel. And the language of the alternative defense counsel statute in some of the case law indicates that it's to provide counsel for indigent defendants. And he said because Mr. Jorgensen now has counsel, it moots out the indigency question. Now, he's no longer indigent, and if he is indigent, he still has counsel representing him. So I cannot, I do no longer have authority under the ADC statute or case law. And that was his position.
Okay, and are you forwarding that position today or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm going on all three positions in point one. One is that it was simply a denial of Mr. Jorgensen's Sixth Amendment right to counsel, or choice of counsel. And second, that the court failed to conduct a hearing on the reasons, both for Mr. Jorgensen's motion to discharge and his and Mr. Braddock's motion to withdraw. And the third would be that under the ADC statute and the case law, that Mr. Braddock did not have authority at that point to continue. Now, there is case law where the court can order that even if it turns out the defendant is not indigent at that point, or that he make order the ADC counsel continue and that he be paid, but that was not done in this case. So I don't think that matters.
And what is the case law that supports that?
I took that out of the answer brief, Your Honor. It indicates on page 17 and 18 of the answer brief that it's CJD 04-4, part 4. If the court determines at any time before, during the course of appointment, or after the appointment of state-funded counsel that a person has the ability to pay all or part of the expenses for representation, the court shall enter an order, a written order, that the person reimburse all or part of the expenses. But that was not done in this case. Your Honor, I also quite strongly believe that the third and fourth points, the third point being when Mr. Helicki, when he was leaving the witness stand, said, "I'm concerned for my safety," which directly goes to the fact that he said Mr. Jorgensen had possessed a weapon in the car when the weapon was found under Mr. Helhakey's seat, and also the admission of the telephone calls. I don't think those show consciousness of guilt. Thank you.
May it please the court, Wendy Ritz, registration number 17024, representing the people in this case. I'd like to first address the defendant's initial claim about the denial of the right to counsel of choice. And the case law makes clear that while defendants do have a right to retain counsel of their choosing, that right is not an absolute right to counsel of choice. And it may not be used to manipulate the administration of justice, or to delay, or for other tactical purposes to delay or impede the trial. And this is an abuse of discretion standard of review, and unless the trial court's actions were manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, and unfair, I think this court is required to uphold the exercise of discretion. A trial court may deny a defendant's motion to discharge his or her attorney if the request is untimely or made for improper purposes. And that's exactly what the trial court found here. In assessing such claims, the trial court considers the timing of the motion, inconvenience to the witnesses, inconvenience to the jurors, the possibility that new counsel will be confronted with similar difficulties, those sort of factors. And the trial court here considered all those factors. It specifically noted that it was required to weigh those factors and made fairly thorough findings. It went through a sort of a procedural review of what had happened in this case up to this point. The defendant was charged in July of 2003, and as the court noted, it's 2006 and he hasn't been tried yet. The court was very concerned with the fact that this case had been delayed and delayed. There had been a number of continuances. The defendant had been represented by numerous attorneys. And there had also been one instance where the defendant had failed to appear at several hearings, and one of which was a trial setting, so the trial had been continued again for that instance. 3 days before trial starts, the court is confronted with a motion from an attorney from out of state who the judge has no idea who he is, saying, I'd like to enter and I'd like to continue the trial again. And the court at that point is very unreceptive. They discuss it the first day of trial when the parties appear. The court allows all the parties, the defendant, his present counsel, and Mr. Henry by telephone to state their positions, their reasons for why this substitution and continuance should be made. The court considers them all, and while the court maybe did not do extensive questioning, I think the court certainly allowed everyone to make their case, and there was an adequate inquiry as required by the case law. It was not required to have a special hearing or do some specific degree of questioning or follow some colloquy. I think basically the court is required to allow the parties to say, what's going on? What's the problem here? And I think partly the court shouldn't be making too much inquiry because there are sort of attorney-client issues that the court might not want to wander into by mistake. So essentially the court should leave it to the parties to say what's happening. Well, the defendant now says, oh, I had problems communicating with my lawyer, and suggests that there was a lack of communication or a breakdown in communication. He made no such assertions to the trial court at the time, and the trial court gave him ample opportunity to state what his problems were at that time. Basically, everything that was talked about were really strategical differences, and the trial court so found. Said, you know, you're not saying, Mr. Henry was not suggesting that Mr. Braddock had really done anything wrong or had in some way there was a conflict of interest, but simply that there were disagreements over how the case should be tried.
Are there certain questions that the court must ask?
I don't think the case law requires that. I think the case law suggests that the court can make an adequate inquiry in a variety of ways. Here, the court had had a continuing relationship with this defendant throughout and had heard the defendant's concerns about a number of attorneys and continued in this manner at this hearing to allow the defendant to state what the reasons were for why he wanted new counsel. The defendant did so and had an opportunity. I don't think the court cut him off or prevented him. I don't think the court was required to do anything, any specific questions beyond that. Mr. Braddock, the ADC attorney, also had an opportunity to discuss the reasons for the discharge, and he mainly emphasized the whole indigency question, which I think if you look at the Chief Justice directives and look at the statutes relating to ADC, they certainly contemplate that there will be cases where a defendant who is indigent when ADC is appointed, which there's no disputing that here. No one is saying the defendant was not indigent at the time and he had no right to ADC. It's clear that he was entitled to ADC at the time, that if during the course of the proceedings, for some reason the defendant is no longer indigent, the representation may continue, and the defendant then will be required to reimburse the court. That's what the statutes and provisions allow for.
Well, Ms. Ritz, I wanted to ask you about the Chief Justice directive and the statutes a little bit more. Do they actually say that representation may continue, or is your argument that it's implied because it provides for reimbursement?
Yeah, I think you're correct. I don't think they specifically say that. I think it's implied within the framework. And I think there's also no case law stating or where it happened that the court then said, oh, you know what, you're not indigent anymore. We're taking your lawyer away and you have to kind of start over. I don't think there's case law where that happened. And I don't think there's case law stating that that is what has to happen. So I think between that absence and the implicit language of the statutes, it clearly contemplates that this is going to happen occasionally. And when that happens, we deal with it by allowing the court to later assess whether reimbursement should be made.
I guess my concern with the statutes and the Chief Justice directive is that it authorizes either public defender or ADC, depending on the statute, to represent an indigent person, and the representation is authorized if the person is indigent. So that seems to be mandatory language in that it's only authorized if the person is indigent. And say if a public defender or an ADC counsel would become aware their client is no longer indigent, wouldn't they have a duty to inform the court, and would the court have any duty to inquire about the indigency?
You know, I'm not sure. I haven't given that a lot of thought, I'd have to say. I think that when you look at the language of the statute, it does talk about at the time appointment is made, the defendant needs to be indigent. And then when you look at the other statutes that talk about reimbursement, they contemplate that if the court determines at any time before, during the course of appointment, at the court's discretion, if questions concerning indigence arise, or after the appointment of state-funded counsel, the court may then. It seems that I'm not certain there's case law that deals with what might be some things that are left unsaid about what happens in that instance. When that happens and they realize this defendant is no longer indigent, it appears that the representation can continue, but the statutes don't directly address that situation. Okay. And I think that given the language of the reimbursement statute, it suggests that that is one approach. I think the trial court, within its discretion, can do that. I think another thing that we need to remember here is that the defendant made no showing that he was no longer indigent. No one came in with financial records. The defendant talked about how he, in February of 2005, he had talked about retaining counsel at a hearing a year before we actually came to trial. Nothing came of it. And then right before trial, suddenly he had managed to find the money, but it's not clear where that came from. Did it come from the defendant? Did it come from his family? It's just left unsaid, and he brings in no financial records. Mr. Braddock, who was concerned about this issue, did not come forward with any financial records saying, here's proof that I should no longer be representing the defendant. So I think that's another factor that plays into this, is the court had to go with what it had before it at the time. This case had been dragging on. The court was anxious to get the trial started, and I think it certainly acted within its discretion under the circumstances. Unless there are any further questions, I'll briefly, I guess, discuss the mistrial and the telephone records. As to the mistrial, for the defendant's brief statement about the witness's concern for his safety at the conclusion of his testimony, a mistrial is a drastic remedy. The trial court heard the statements. The trial court, in context, realized that this simply did not warrant a mistrial. Given the context of his testimony, defense counsel elicited a great deal of testimony about threats. Anyway, this particular statement had made no direct reference to the defendant. The trial court instructed the jury to disregard it. Under the circumstances, I think the trial court, again, acted well within its discretion. And similarly, as to the phone records, the prosecutor argued and the trial court determined that they went to the consciousness of guilt. And I think if you look at the case law, and I think in the Medina case, it also involved phone calls to the jail, and it was a similar situation. And as in that case, here, the phone records, the defendant's phone conversations showed his consciousness of guilt, and that he was trying to either get the witness to change their story or just to leave town entirely, and he would pay them not to come to the trial if they wouldn't change their story. So the case law indicates that such testimony can be used to show the defendant's sort of knowledge of his involvement and consciousness of guilt and attempt to affect the outcome of the trial. If there are no further questions, then I would ask the court to affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
All right, Mr. McFarland, you have about 2 minutes and 48 seconds left.
I'll try and talk fast. As the court knows from reading the transcript, much of the trial court's concerns about a delay of the trial. I think the ADC counsel made a very good suggestion here, and that is that Mr. Jorgensen had been arrested for another offense about 6 months earlier. There was a trial set in that case in May of 2006, or 3 months after the trial. In this case, he suggested that the trial be moved forward that 3-month period to allow Mr. Henry to get up to date and proceed through trial at that time. So the delay would have been a three-month delay, or could easily have been a three-month delay. And a review of the transcript also shows the, while the court allowed the, Mr. Braddock to make a record and Mr. Jorgensen, Mr. Braddock talked mostly about his conversations with Mr. Henry. He did not make a good record or really much of a record at all on his representation of Mr. Jorgensen or any reasons they were not getting along. And that
Counsel,
I think...
I'd like to ask you the same question I asked the Attorney General. Are there certain questions that the trial court must ask?
Not that I know of. I only know... such as Maestas says, when faced with a request to terminate counsel, the trial court has a duty to make a careful inquiry about the defendant's right to counsel and his or her decision representing or regarding legal representation. And it goes on, the trial court must inquire into the reasons for the defendant's dissatisfaction to determine whether there's good cause to substitute counsel.
As I understand it here, the court allowed Mr. Henry, Mr. Braddock, and defendant all three to speak.
Yes.
Why isn't that an inquiry within the meaning of the case law?
He allowed them to speak, but the court never went into the specific reasons why Mr. Jorgensen felt Mr. Braddock was not being effective. And this is really... I don't want to get into the effective assistance of counsel because we're going on the Sixth Amendment right to choice of counsel. There's a difference. And this simply goes to the duty to make an inquiry. The court did not make that inquiry, did not make any specific inquiry beyond asking Mr. Jorgensen, what medications are you on and how long have you been on them? He didn't ask him any specific questions about his dissatisfaction, even though Mr. Jorgensen made a statement, any dissatisfaction about his representation of counsel. I see my time is up. And that's the best answer I can give you on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.